We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
For 18 years, I've truly been blessed to be a Pacer and a Hoosier.
You're listening to Setting the Pace, your go-to Pacers podcast with Alex Golden and Michael Facci.
Caris LeVert, people don't realize how good he really is.
LeVert, skies high for the Jam.
McConnell pushing again, gets underneath, finds Sabonis for the dunk and the foul.
Brogdon for three.
Boom, baby!
Duarte for three.
Big time shot.
Warren lets it fly. Yes!
T.J. Warren is not human!
All right, everybody. Ladies and gentlemen of Setting the Pace, we are back. I am joined today by a recently single out of a relationship with Moses Moody, Alex Golden. Alex, how are you doing today?
Man, I hate to say it, but I moved on quick. It was more of a fling thing there with Moses Moody, but I've moved on. He's in California. I'm in Indiana. Can't think the long distance relationship up anymore. So I am I'm full fledged in on Chris Duarte. He is a guy that I just can't imagine my life without. Fudge.
Hey, I don't blame you there. Chris Duarte looked real good in game one. I know it was, he didn't drop 20 to 30 points, but he looked efficient, looked confident. This is a guy who I feel like can create his own shot and is not afraid to take the big shot.
No, I mean, we saw a couple different things from him in that first game of Summer League, and I know that the game two is going on right now as we're talking, but that first game, man, he had a nice steal. He had a nice pull-up three, a little step back. I mean, this guy is showing us some things, and I get that it's Summer League. I'm not overreacting. I just think, can this guy play basketball? We see highlights. We see games and footage from Oregon and how he played there, and he looked really good. The Pacers were really high on him for a reason. I think that he's going to be a part of this rotation going forward. I am really enamored by his game, Fletch.
I really am. And you can't sleep on that two-handed block that he had.
Oh, yeah.
Just really flashing on both sides of the ball. I mean, just really, it was very encouraging. Isaiah Jackson, limited minutes, still had two blocks. So, and that was also barely having any practice time at all. So I feel like I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt that his minutes will continue to grow during Summer League, and I think we'll see more and more production out of Isaiah.
Oh, yeah. There was already an alley-oop pass from Duarte to Isaiah Jackson in the first quarter, I believe, of the Summer League game. So pretty cool to see that. I mean, Isaiah Jackson, he's a pogo stick, man. He can jump out of the gym. And, you know, I'm just a big fan of him. I'm glad that we got him, and we'll see what he does. I'm assuming he's going to play most of his time in the G League, but that's neither here or there. I'm excited to see him grow as a prospect. But Facci, today on our podcast, we had a lengthy conversation with Indy Star beat writer Jay Michael discussing everything that's happened pretty much going back a little bit to last season, but mostly since the offseason started. We pretty much hit on everything besides, you know, the Carlisle hire, which I think we've talked about that enough, but talked about his assistants, talked about all the rumors that have been going around. I thought this was a really great conversation.
A lot of great stuff. Hadn't spoke with Jay in a while, so we had to cover, you know, all the off-season activities and just little bits and pieces of what he's been hearing lately of what the team might do. Still a lot of unanswered questions, but you could tell the Pacers might be up to something with a few of the moves that they've made that Jay discusses with us.
Yeah, he dropped some really interesting nuggets in this one like he always does. So I hope you guys, you know, stay tuned for that. But whether you like him or not, everything that he's been reporting, I'm not just saying this to kiss his butt. I really believe it. I mean, he has absolutely been killing it with his coverage of this team. I mean, everything that he's reporting has come to light. And I you know, when a guy is consistently doing it and is accurate, you got to give credit where credit's due.
Absolutely. I had to tip my hat on a few of the calls that he made weeks in advance of the draft or free agency because they were accurate.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's take a quick break. And after this break, we're going to bring on the one and only Jay Michael to talk all things Pacers offseason. We'll be right back after this.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
What's going on, everybody? We are joined right now by Indy Star beat writer for the Indiana Pacers, Jay Michael. Jay, thanks for coming on the show.
Good, man. Long time no talk. Guess some things have changed, so there's some stuff to talk about, right?
Absolutely. Focci, go ahead with the first question.
Oh, that we do. I mean, Jay, free agency, I don't want to say it wrapped up for the Pacers, but it got off to a quick start that then kind of, you know, tailored off. Haven't seen much movement, but the first move the Pacers made, immediately re-signing TJ McConnell. I mean, did you think, was there any ever any real doubt that McConnell was going to come back to the Pacers?
Nah, there was no doubt since February. I mean, every piece of reporting that I'd done leading up to that moment was, you know, McConnell's coming back. McConnell's prioritized over McDermott, and that was clear. I knew that, like I said, even way before All-Star break. Just because of conversations I've had with people leading up, and they knew they couldn't keep Doug. They knew they wouldn't be able to afford him. Obviously, they did a sign and trade, obviously, to get him to where he wanted to go and keep his bird rights intact, I guess. And, you know, and that was the plan all along. It was just a question of where McDermott was going to end up. But McConnell was a lock because – he's Indiana in terms of the kind of style and the kind of hustle they want to see with their guys in the second unit. And his contract, you know, it's a career high, you know, it's the biggest contract of his career, but it's also a kind of contract that based on the cap number that the Pacers were dealing with, it was a kind of contract that they also could come to terms with him on pretty quickly. So this was not a bunch of hand wringing and what should we do? What shouldn't we do? This was set in stone for months, and I think you saw that with the way it went down in free agency.
Yeah, I think we all kind of accepted that early in free agency, just kind of, or I guess the offseason, thinking that McDermott would be the one to leave because, look, $14.5 million per year is a lot of money for Doug McDermott. So let me ask you this. With them doing the sign-in trade, that was official, I believe, Sunday, Can you kind of walk us through why, you know, the Spurs would agree to a sign and trade with the Pacers for Doug McDermott and what kind of trade exception that creates for the Pacers to use for the next, you know, I think it's less than an actual year, but close to a year now.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the sign and trade thing, you know, you see the sign and trades, a lot of them expire. Excuse me, not the sign and trades, but the trade exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of teams, they have them that expire, that they never use them. So you have a small window in which to use it. But it basically allows you to acquire a player without having to give up anything. That's kind of the quick and easy way to explain the trade exception. But it kind of comes down to if you have a good relationship with a player and you know, you're on good terms, you say, you know, hey, look, he's going to leave. We can't pay him. And you tell his agent to find the trade part. Is, you know, if they want to do a sign and trade, you'll do it because that way it serves both sides, right? McDermott can kind of pick the team he wants to go to, which is San Antonio. San Antonio, you know, is going to pay him this number. You orchestrate a sign and trade so that when he gets sent to San Antonio, he doesn't start over at zero when it comes to his years of service in terms of his bird rights. So that allows him to be able to get bigger raises. And that's a big thing to guys like that. That's why you do it as a sign and trade. The flip side on how it benefits a team like the Pacers is, as we just talked about, the trade exception. You're able to orchestrate that. I mean, technically, when LeBron left Cleveland to go to Miami, it was a sign and trade. Though really, it's in the same thing here, but it's really a free agent move, but you set it up as a sign and trade. So the team that's losing the player has something that maybe it can show for and an asset that it can use in the future that might allow it to benefit as well. So it really serves both sides. It's when both sides are – and look, when LeBron did it, it wasn't an amicable thing, but it makes sense as the team that was the rights holder of McDermott, in this case the Pacers, to do that so they can have that trade exception and gives them some options going forward into the season.
You know, when you talk about those options, I've heard various reports, whether it's a $7.3 million trade exception or 7.4. Either way, you know, it's right in that range. We also saw the Pacers move back Keelan Martin's guarantee date to, I believe it's now August 31st on his contract for the $1.7 million. The Pacers, now that they have this trade exception, Jay, how do you think they're going to use it?
I mean, the Keelan Martin thing is kind of curious. I've seen teams move back the guarantee date. What they normally do when they move back the guarantee date is they give the guy you know, $50,000 to agree to move back to guarantee date. I saw this happen when I was in Washington with Jarrell Eddie when he was with the Wizards. And they pushed his guarantee date because they weren't sure what they were going to do. They gave him some, you know, I think they may have even given him $100,000 at the time to push it. And they ended up not guaranteeing his contract. It's kind of hard to say what's going to happen as a result of that when they push it. But yeah, I mean, it gives the Pacers, like, they have what, three guys, if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, on two ways, right?
Right now, currently, yeah.
At this moment, you know, you can only have two.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're still trying to figure out what kind of moves they're going to make. I wouldn't be surprised if something happened before the season. That trade exception, by the way, like, I haven't looked at the adjusted CBA rules, but in terms of using that in a trade itself, I can't recall. I know you can break it up.
Right.
No, yep.
Wait, can you or can you not break it up? I'm confusing.
I think as long as it's under the $7 million, I don't know if you can break it up, but you can acquire somebody that doesn't make the full. I think it's exactly. Supposed to be like $7.3 million.
Mm-hmm. Right. You don't have to use the whole thing.
Right. But you can't combine it with like a Jeremy Lamb plus
exactly.
Exception.
Correct. So it gives them a lot of options. I don't know what they're going to end up doing with it, if anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
It gives them – that tells me that plus pushing Keelan's guarantee date, that they're still trying to figure out some things. And does that mean Keelan's definitely not going to come back as a result of the tale I told you about Jarrell Eddie? No. But it buys them time. Because they haven't quite settled on what they're going to do yet. I don't know what they're going to do with it.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious to see what they do with those two-way contracts. I would assume Amita Brima is not retained just because they drafted Isaiah Jackson, probably give Cassius Stanley that second two-way contract to go with Dwayne Washington, who just had a fantastic Monday game. I don't think he missed but like one shot the entire game. So I think that Stanley and Washington are the most likely to be on there, but we'll see what happens. I know that the biggest thing Pacer fans keep asking is, what are they going to do with Jeremy Lamb and his expiring $10.5 million contract? There's been rumblings that they've tried to trade him, but it's just I don't really know what's really out there for him, what his value is. So have you heard anything on that front?
I haven't heard anything on that front. That's been kind of a not-so-big secret for months now, that they've been kind of, you know, they've been looking at ways to part with him. Because even if, you know, A, you got the health issues that he came off of with that broken leg, and you saw him having issues last season as well. And then B, even if he's healthy, where does he fit? Especially when you have a guy like Duarte, who I think you really want to give more time to than really relying on Jeremy Lamb, who's expiring, who's not going to be around for the long haul. Look, his contract isn't a bad contract. It's only $10.5 million. So I expect maybe once the season starts, there's going to probably be a team. And this is provided Jeremy Lamb himself is healthy. If he's healthy, I think they'd like to get Jeremy Lamb out on the floor the way they did Victor Oladipo before they traded him. So everybody can see, he's okay. He can play. He's fine. And when teams see that, then they're more likely to make a deal, especially once the season starts. Somebody's going to lose a guard. Somebody's going to lose a scorer to some sort of injury, whether, you know, long-term or for the season. And they're going to need a guy like a Jeremy Lamb you can bring off the bench. And then the interest, I think, in him grows. But I don't think the Pacers, you know, I don't think there's a clamoring like, hey, we want Jeremy Lamb from 29 other teams in the league. And I don't think that right now the Pacers, for instance, would want to, say, buy him out just to make him go away and clear a roster spot. I don't think his contract is not that kind of burdensome. But, yeah, I just don't sense right now that there's a whole lot of activity for Lamb. But I think they're hoping at some point soon, obviously before the trade deadline, either they can deal him or put him in some sort of package as a throw-in to be able to clear an extra roster spot. Because, you know, and let's face it, who knows? Maybe Dwayne, the kid, who were we just saying?
Dwayne Washington.
Maybe a guy like Washington or somebody turns out to blow them away and is like, hey, we got to get a roster spot for this guy. And okay, maybe that changes and you make a more aggressive move just to try to give Lamb away, just to clear not just a two-way spot, but a spot for somebody that maybe they see something, not only with these free agents that they have, but you can't forget these other teams in Summer League, they have good free agents too who are on their teams that aren't locked into those teams. You might want to pull somebody from another team that you've seen in Summer League that's impressive who isn't on a guaranteed deal with someone. So there's always a possibility that you can make a more aggressive move to that end too. So that's why I'm saying they're keeping their options kind of open. And I think Lamb's going to be gone. It's just a question of how quick it's going to happen and the method in which it's going to happen. I just can't see him ending the season still on a roster with the Pacers. I can't see that.
Now the Lamb trade market does seem rather dry at this moment, but you know, just like you mentioned, I can't see him finishing the season, but similar to the point you made on Oladipo, at least starting last year with the Pacers being healthy, I think it really did help his trade value. But one free agent signing that kind of came a little bit of a surprise. We did a live reaction here when free agency just started. When Torrey Craig got signed maybe 15 minutes into free agency, Jay, had you heard any rumblings about Torrey Craig and the Pacers, and what do you think his role will be with this team this season?
No, I actually didn't hear a lot of rumbling about that. But it was clear, you know, obviously the only other kind of move they could have made is something with someone like a Torrey Craig, given the salary cap constraints and kind of what their need was, you know. So much talk, you know, last year, and I reported a lot about this, about they felt like they didn't have the locker room culture, the toughness, that kind of defensive guy that they can rely on. And, you know, Craig has kind of shown some ability to do some of that last few seasons, actually. So, no, he came out of left field. That doesn't mean that, you know, I'm sure they already had their hooks into him early in the process. I doubt if anybody came to terms within 15 minutes of free agency opening, that tells you that they already had something lined up.
Because of course,
the Pacers had to lock in their biggest contract in free agency, which most teams do. That's the first signing. But then that was McConnell. And then you slot in Torrey Craig. So it makes sense of why they would sign him. There's a, you know, you can kind of wonder, like, how do they, what lineups are you going to use? How does this fit? If you take Rick Carlisle at his word that, you know, he's going to use, you know, you hear coaches promise to use everybody we have. And then when the season comes, they basically do the opposite. Carlisle seems to insist that he's really thinking about the long term going into the postseason and saving guys on their minutes. So you have to figure a guy like Craig factors in at some point. Exactly how they use him, I mean, I got to see them play a few games together first. I just don't have a clue on how all the pieces fit, or if getting Torrey Craig is kind of a move that's going to ultimately produce another move, as I said, before we get into the regular season. I just feel like, and I've been kind of told, don't rule out another move happening before the regular season starts. It's just not clear to me. Is that just a minor move, or is that a big move? And so I think that's going to determine how a guy like Torrey Craig fits in. How does a guy like Cassius Stanley fits in? If he's going to get any playing time as a two-way player, how does Keelan Martin fit in? Is he going to stick around after his guarantee date? Because you just don't know.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting things here with this Pacers roster. And I know you've kind of addressed some of it. You said don't expect Turner or Brogdon to be traded, but it still could happen. Brogdon, the more likely of the two to be traded. I want to circle back to that in a little bit. But first, I am kind of wondering if you have any updates on Goga Batadze and maybe why he's not with the team other than what they've reported as personal reasons.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I haven't been around the team for the last, you know, I begged out of going to Vegas after the Delta variant kind of stuff happening. And I see all this craziness taking place on planes and people trying to open doors. So I didn't feel real comfortable about traveling because you guys might see me in the news for beating someone to death on a plane if that happens. So no, actually I haven't heard any details beyond, you know, at first, remember, I think they said it was his back.
Right.
And it's always something, you know, the funny thing, I'll tell you what I do know about Goga. Like his first year was a complete waste of a year. You know, he wasn't in shape. He didn't know I was told he didn't realize what it took to be an NBA player. And his conditioning just wasn't up to par. And he underestimated weight training, and he really got in the gym. He got physically stronger. Last season, you saw he was in better shape. He showed flashes of being a little bit closer to what you needed him to be, but he still has a ways to go. But it always seems like it's something. If it's not that first year where he, you know, I guess he was 19 years old, so you figure a guy 19 may not know what it takes to play in the NBA. And he had to learn that the hard way. The second thing is last year, you know, every time it seemed like, or even going into the bubble that first season, he always had a leg injury. He kept missing, and there was just no continuity with him. And then you saw things like that happen last year too, but he was a little bit better and more consistent last year. So whatever the case with him going into year three, I would love to see him just to be able to have a normal, complete season with no interruptions so you can finally get a figure out exactly who he is and what he's going to be. Because even if you wanted to say put him in a deal and rework the roster, exactly what are you going to get from him at this point? And I don't think you're going to get a lot because nobody exactly knows. So I expect him. I don't know beyond what most of us already know in terms of what's going on with him. You know, they need him to get a complete season and to be in shape and be healthy. And, you know, obviously it's kind of disappointing that he's not in this summer league. Cause I was looking forward to seeing him because he's a guy that really needs that work.
I think that Goga above every other player would have benefited the most from being in the summer league after not being able to participate the last 2 years. So that was a shame. Obviously we hope everything goes well with his family and our condolences to his family. But while we're sticking on summer league for now, Cassius Stanley, should he be feeling a little bit of pressure that his two-way spot might not be a for sure guarantee? Because I know it's just one game, it's early, failed to really make an impact against the Knicks. Should Stanley be feeling the pressure at all?
I don't think he feels pressure right now. Look, here's what I do know about him. he didn't have a G League last year, right?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have a summer league last year. And, you know, and then he played on a team that was four games under 500 and barely got on the court because Nate Bjorkgren pretty much forgot about him. And I feel like this is really his first season. Because his actual first season in the league to me was a waste. It was a throwaway. So I don't think he feels pressure. You know, they gave him a qualifying offer. I expect him to accept it based on what I've been told, unless the Pacers change their mind and pull it at the last minute. I think when you're drafted, if he were a free agent pickup on a two-way deal, I would be worried if I were him. But the fact that the Pacers invested a pick in him, even though that pick came in the 50s, that gives him a little bit more security because teams want to give guys like that a chance to succeed more because you are our pick. We're selected. They want to be able to say, we found this guy. This is our guy we developed. So he's going to get a little, he's going to get more rope than a guy who, you know, who's just a free agent pickup, who they don't really have any resources invested in yet. And I think, like I said about last year on the Bjorkgren, you know, Stanley was supposed to play late in the season. I was told the front office had talked to Bjorkgren about that, about, hey, you got Cassius Stanley there, you know, all those injuries. And here they are getting blown out by 40 points in a game, and you'll see his stat line, and he played 2 minutes. It's like, what are you doing? And so I think that was a source of huge frustration for him because Bjorkgren told him that he was going to use him in certain games and, hey, get ready. And then the guy wouldn't break a sweat and wouldn't put him in the game. So I think they understand what he went through in his first year as well. And that was kind of unfair to him. And he suffered because of that. Plus, like I said, they invested a draft pick in him. So I wouldn't think that he should sweat at this point with the qualifying offer already put out there for him. I think he's going to be okay, at least in the short term. And we're still having this conversation, you know, at this point next year, or, you know, maybe in the middle of the season, he gets some time to play and he doesn't look good. I'd be okay. Maybe it's a different conversation then, but I think he's okay for right now.
Yeah. Cause I want to say, if I believe it was early in the season last year against Phoenix, there was like a 4 minute stretch there where he played really well. And I thought, okay, I mean, this guy's athletic. He's a second round pick. You don't usually see second round picks get much playing time, especially their first year in the NBA. But you know, with all the injuries, like you said, I was a little bit surprised. And the Bjorkgren era obviously was one that all of Pacer Nation is quickly trying to forget and move on from. We are excited about Rick Carlisle and what he brings to the table. But I do kind of want to circle back now to the draft night where the Pacers selected Chris Duarte with the 13th overall pick. You had been on this reporting-wise for months talking about this is kind of the guy. This is the guy they want to go after. All of Pacer Nation was really glued to Moses Moody. I feel like it was almost a unified group that wanted Moses, but Chris Duarte is the guy, and he looked pretty good in his first game for Summer League, just very mature for, you know, for a rookie, but he is 24 years old. My biggest question, though, about Duarte is, do you anticipate him cracking that 10-man rotation right away?
I do, because I know they view him that highly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, The you know, Duarte is like, you know, if Duarte wasn't 24, if he were like 22 instead, would the backlash have been as great? I don't think so. But I think if you just look at the skill, there are countless people who I talked to at Oregon, scouts who from other teams, you know, people think when I talk about what's going on, I only know people who know about the Pacers. You know, I've covered most teams in this league at some point. I know people on staffs around the league, you know, people who are on staffs that you currently cover, they'll end up on other staffs around the league on other teams. So, you know, I know people from staffs all over and what they thought about Duarte, and their view was starkly different than the Moses Moody crowd. And, you know, who knows, maybe they end up being right. Maybe they end up being wrong. I mean, draft picks is, you know, it's hard to gauge about who's going to succeed and who's not. There's a formula to get it right every time. You get it right every time. And here you are with teams. They have more information. They know more about these guys that people on the outside looking in will never know, good and bad. And they've seen things that you'll never see. They've seen medicals that you'll never see. And all of that kind of factors into how they come at the conclusions they do. And even despite that, that's no guarantee they're going to get it right still. That's how hard it is to gauge these guys. So Duarte, I expect him to crack the rotation. I think Rick Carlisle's influence and his impact in terms of what he wants on that team, he wants a guy with big guy at that pick who could play. And, you know, I've never been one to get too jacked up about Summer League. The only thing Summer League tells me is that you have a chance to play and be good. It doesn't guarantee that you're going to be great or anything. But if you look really bad in Summer League, like TJ Leaf, it tells you you probably are going to have trouble playing in the big show.
Yo.
To me, that's like almost like a line of demarcation. If you can't show that you could play in Summer League, I have some real concerns about you. But if you show that you can, it means there's some hope. So, but yeah, I expect Duarte to contribute. I expect him to play. And I expect him to, you know, it's not that I think he's going to get 20 minutes a game right off the bat, but I think at some point, by the time we get deep into the season, I think he could be at that level in the rotation, that he's not just an afterthought that you throw in, you know, when you're down 20 or up 20 with 2 minutes left in the game. I think he's going to play some meaningful minutes.
And that's definitely what we're looking for. And Jay, I definitely want to tip my hat to you because, you know, you were on that Chris Duarte to Indiana train for at least it felt like a week or two in advance of the draft. But you also had an interesting report that I'd love to hear you elaborate on a bit. You mentioned that even after the draft, Golden State was still pursuing trades for Chris Duarte.
Yes.
Was there anything that you could expand upon in terms of that report?
Well, I know I had multiple people tell me that Duarte was told on the bus to the draft. He was told by a Golden State official that he would be their pick at 14. Okay. And when I say multiple people, I'm not talking about when I say sources, I don't know who some people use as sources that turn out to be wrong. I'm not talking about the janitor or somebody who's driving the bus. So now when I first reported that, someone from Golden State, and I know their front office pretty well. Someone from Golden State called me or texted me that night, told me my information was wrong. And I said, yep. I said, well, it's like I was in there and I'm telling you that that's not what happened. I was like, well, I do know that owner Joe Lacob, when that pick happened, slammed his, when I say the pick happened, when the Pacers took Duarte, Joe Lacob slammed his fist on the table when he was taken. So I don't know what you saw that told you that you got that that wasn't your pick. But then you saw a guy, Monty Poole from the Bay Area, who covers Golden State for NBC Bay Area. He's been covering Golden State for like the better part of two decades. Then came out and confirmed my report was accurate. So, and so he knew as well that what I had was spot on. There were calls being made. Golden State did want to try to get Chris Duarte because they viewed him. This is the funny thing. If you listen to the broadcast that night, I think it was ESPN broadcast. Somebody on there made a reference to him being Klay Thompson light or something like Klay Thompson.
Yeah, Jay Billis. Jay Billis called him a poor man's Klay Thompson.
You know who said that he was a Klay Thompson clone? The Golden State Warriors front office.
Ooh, I love it.
That's how so when he said that, I know who his source of that information is.
Mm-hmm.
So I know what I'm talking about on that. And why would you, by the way, as a team, if you ended up picking Joe Blow as your first round pick, would you admit that, hey, we didn't want him. We wanted a guy that went before him. Nobody's going to
never.
No team is ever going to admit that ever. Mm-hmm. So just because, so I mentioned like, hey, a Golden State official denied the report because that's their position they wanted to get out. The fairness in me and me doing my job, saying they denied it. But I have from a couple people, multiple people, and I don't mean Pacers people per se, who told me about what was said on the bus to Chris Duarte. And he totally expected that Golden State expected him to fall. Now, why didn't Golden State trade up to get ahead of the Pacers to be able to get him? I'm not sure if they tried or if they just thought that he was going to drop to them and that the Pacers are going to take someone else. Yeah, I stand on that 100%. And like I said, the Golden State guy who's been covering that team for the better part of 20 years, who was there on draft night, said what I reported was true. So even if he didn't do that, what I reported was true, but I mean, you know, I guess you can draw your own conclusion if you don't want to believe it. I don't know. Some people say, I don't believe that. I don't believe that. Well, don't believe it. I don't care. I know it's accurate. And the funny thing is they know it's accurate, and that's all that really matters.
Yeah, no, it's funny because people choose to believe what they want to believe. But at the end of the day, you know, you've been backing up everything you've been reporting with the T.J. McConnell stuff, with the Duarte stuff. So, I mean, I don't see why people wouldn't believe what you're saying is true, because it very much seems like you are in the know and you've backed it up several times. And it even goes back to, you know, the couple of seasons before that when McMillan got fired and all that stuff. So, you know, we definitely respect your opinion. That's why we have you on here all the time, because we know we're getting the truth. And another thing that you brought up in an article after the two signings were made official with Torrey Craig and T.J. McConnell, or they were reported, I should say, you did bring up the fact that Miles Turner might come off the bench. It's something that's being talked about, I guess. I'm not sure. You said a league source told you that.
Yes.
Would you anticipate Miles coming off the bench, number one, and how do you think he would go about accepting it, and how do the Pacers look with that starting five if he's not in the starting five?
Well, number one, I'll start with the easy one first. Would he be okay with it? Absolutely not. I don't anticipate that at all. Like,
right.
That would take a whole lot of talking to in order to make that. Like, I just don't exactly. And what would the lineup look like if you didn't do that? I don't know.
Yeah.
Does that mean they're going to make a move before the season starts, which is going to make it a non-issue? Possibly. And that's why I think that option's on the table. Could it be a permanent not start Miles Turner, or could it be a case where, you know, there's going to be some times when Carlisle starts him and other times that he doesn't? That I think a lot of stuff is on the table. Just like, you know, I think just about every player, every significant player on that team has been discussed in some sort of deal leading up to free agency. Not meaning the Pacers are trying to push them out the door, but that they were willing to listen and talk about, you know, these are the possibilities, or, you know, what could you get for this or that? I mean, because they were that open, I think, to reshaping how the team was going to look. And so there's a lot of possibilities out there. I never talked about some of them were just kind of far-fetched and far off, and there was no way it was going to happen. But yeah, I expect it's possible that Turner comes off the bench. Maybe he doesn't start, if he's still with the team, maybe they don't start the season that way. But I think, you know, I think the difference between Carlisle and Bjorkgren, I think every time I say Nate Bjorkgren's name, like, Pacers people go, who? Because that's what they want to forget him. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the biggest differences is that Bjorkgren said last year to me, and I asked him about it, that he was open to splitting the bigs. And this was early in the process, like in the training camp. And then I asked Miles Turner about what would he think if he was the odd man out, if that happened. And then he says he was really peeved about it. And he's like, he's never talked to me about that. Where do you get that from? I was like, I asked Nate Bjorkgren about this a couple of days ago. And he said, da, 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 da. And Miles found it is like, this is news to me. I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that. That's how I know he wouldn't take it kindly, because he was almost angry at the question that I asked him about coming off the bench. I think the difference is, if Carlisle was open to doing that, he would have had that conversation with his players already. Whereas I don't think Bjorkgren had the confidence or the authority to feel like he could do that. So no, I don't think Miles would be crazy about it. I think he might say, why don't you just trade me then? If that happened, I think that's possible. But I think the Pacers are open to making sorts of adjustments. They've done a lot of talk about adjusting and changing, but when they got Bjorkman in last year, we expected all this adjusting and changing about how you do things. And he adjusted and changed in ways that mostly weren't good. So I think they got to now, they preached it a lot. And this year, they're going to have to practice some of that stuff they've said, because for the last season and a half, two seasons, they've come up short in terms of their promise in doing so.
You know, Miles has put up with quite a lot. And one of the things that you're going to add to the list is the Pacers ended up packaging Aaron Holiday and 4 second-round picks to move up to 22 and snag yet another center in Isaiah Jackson, who, mind you, is a very good shot blocker. Do you envision any role at all for Isaiah this year with the Pacers?
Not if Miles Turner stays.
I agree.
If Turner stays. If now, obviously, if something happens in terms of that Turner front, then obviously, you know, of, you know, there should be a role for him because, you know, you need a shot blocker in there. And, you know, and I don't know if you can trust, you can't really trust Goga in that role, at least not now. So yeah. Yeah, that was that's why when I say looking into the start of the season, there just seems to be a couple of variables in play, and I'm not sure which one is real and which one isn't. Is Turner being moved real, which then makes Isaiah Jackson more of a real option? Is there something else in play or some other package that's going to get Malcolm Brogdon out of there? I mean, I think, as I've said, I think the Brogdon thing was probably closer to being, if something had to happen, you know, as I reported, I felt like the Brogdon kicking the tires on Brogdon was more significant, actually, because the question has been, can he make guys around him better? It's not a question of whether or not he's a good player. It's not a question of whether or not Brogdon can do some things, spot up, shoot really well, that he's, you know, but is he the type of ball handling guard that you need? Can he make those other guys around him better? And will the chemistry and all of those other intangibles be better with another point guard? And to me, that's the big one on what they do with Brogdon going forward, because that's a year ago, I would have said, no, there's no way that's on the table. This year, that seems to be on the table more so than Miles Turner, in my opinion. But and maybe they end up thinking that moving Miles Turner and getting some other pieces for him will make Brogdon better. I don't know. But I think there's so many questions to figure out. And there's no way this team looks the same, guys, by the time you get to after the trade deadline this year. So regardless of what happens between now and the start of the season, I think there's going to be some significant, at least one significant move by the time you get past the trade deadline in 2022.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Yeah, so I definitely want to touch a little bit on that Brogdon conversation, because you did say he would be the most likely to be traded out of the five you guessed. And there were some rumblings about a Lonzo Ball for Brogdon sign-and-trade that was out there. And I heard Jonathan Givony and Zach Lowe talk about it on their podcast. And Givony brought up that, you know, while Bjorkren was part of the problem, there still could be hanging fruit in terms of locker room issues in there after bringing up Brogdon being a guy that could be traded. So is there maybe some skepticism there of Brogdon and his leadership in the locker room? And is there any other reason why they might be willing to move him other than maybe just not him being that natural point guard they want?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, you got to remember when McMillan got booted, you know, I reported at the time, Brogdon was the leading voice in the locker room that he needed to go. And, you know, Bjorkren and Brogdon were besties when last season started. And, you know, I kind of hesitate to look, Brogdon wasn't the best leader last year. There was a belief that Sabonis wasn't the best leader either, but Brogdon was a little bit more demonstrative, I think. You know, I kind of give them both a little benefit of the doubt, because I thought Bjorkren's leadership as a coach was so terrible. It contributed to that. And I'm kind of hesitate to rip them for everything that went wrong. But I will tell you this, you know, when I did my Oladipo report, you know, about him wanting to play for other teams, one of the things that I was told at that time, there's a detail in that story where I talk about how he turned off a bunch of guys on the team when it came to, they were doing a Zoom call and they were talking about social justice stuff and things that were going on. And his nonchalant kind of apathetic attitude also kind of ticked off some guys. I'm talking about Oladipo here. During that same call, Brogdon, I was told, basically told a couple of guys on the team who had opinions to, I'm not quoting it here, but basically it was interpreted as, y'all need to shut up, I got this. That it came from almost a, it felt like he was being a little bit arrogant. And well, I didn't really talk about it or write about it because I just thought it was, you know, the whole piece A was about Oladipo. And I thought maybe, yeah, maybe that's a little bit, I didn't have it on authority from anyone else that they felt salty about it. But then later on I heard like, yeah, there was a particular player on the team that was salty about the way Brogdon talked to him. So is that indicative of him in general as a leader? I don't know. I think there may be something to that. And, you know, and I do get the sense that they've soured on him, because if you just listen to the postseason conference that Kevin Pritchard gave after they were eliminated, when he said that he told everybody in exits he was looking for a leader in the locker room. Wait, hold up a minute. You're looking for a leader in the locker room? I thought Malcolm Brogdon was your leader. You guys couldn't not stop but saying how great of a leader Brogdon was his first year, year and a half there. All we heard about was his leadership. And now this is the conversation you're having with your team that you had no leaders in the locker room last year? I mean, so you don't have to name Malcolm Brogdon there, but it means that something's gone sour when it comes to his leadership, because otherwise Pritchard wouldn't have said that. He didn't say, other than Malcolm Brogdon, I need other leaders. He said he had no leaders last year. And, you know, my kind of autopsy on the season, you know, when I had the piece about Pritchard having to go into that locker room, you know, I was able to confirm four times. It may have been even more than that. But he had to go in there four times to basically read them the riot act because of the way they were playing with no heart, with no soul. They were downright, they were a selfish group. And I know some people have taken issue with me saying selfish, and like, how could you call them selfish? That's not my opinion they were selfish. The opinion, I think, at large, when they evaluated their season, was that they played selfish basketball. And so apparently there were some things happening in the locker room that were being said, that was being done, that goes beyond statistics, that told them that they were not playing for each other, that they were really playing for individuals. And if Malcolm Brogdon is your leader and that's still happening, then, and you're saying you're still looking for a leader, it means you want for something. There's something that's not, that's, did something change on Brogdon? Did his attitude change? Or maybe was he never the leader you thought he was to begin with? I'm not sure what the answer is to that, but I think that's definitely a legitimate, legitimate issue when it comes to who they are going forward. And because that's why I say Brogdon is more likely to get moved, that's another reason, than Turner. If you told me that they could move both of them, one or the other, and they had deals that are equal for both, and they could only move one, I think they would move Brogdon in that case. Because Turner's not that kind of guy that I think has a reputation or is seen as, you know, a guy who's going to be bad for locker room culture. But there's huge questions about Brogdon in that regard. I think that's real.
You know, Jay, I find it very interesting you said that, because Alex made me out to be almost a conspiracy theorist of how I thought it was the silence regarding Malcolm Brogdon in Pritchard's press conference I felt was very loud to me compared to about a year or two ago when they had nothing but praise for Brogdon. Because, you know, we heard the praise on LeVert. We heard the praise very loudly on TJ Warren. But for Brogdon, it seemed a little bit quiet. And as we're sticking on the subject, TJ Warren, for right now, his one-year anniversary of him dropping 53 points in the bubble just happened, made Pacers fans almost shed a tear as to, we miss him very much. Do you have any update on maybe the health status of TJ Warren at this moment?
About a month ago, I was told he's ready to go. Yeah, that there shouldn't be any setbacks. He shouldn't be starting the season out on minutes restrictions or any of that sort of stuff. He should be past that right now. He's TJ should be fine. And, you know, despite, you know, I've never been one to, like, the way people try to piss on my reporting, I've never been one to do that to other people's or other things other people say. But, you know, he never asked to leave Indiana. And I believe that wholeheartedly based on all the people that I know and I've talked to, one in particular who's really close to him. Yeah, he's healthy. He's ready to go. I think TJ is, you know, he's that guy. Like, he thinks he's going, from what I was told, okay, aside from him really liking Indiana, there's like a lot of people who will tell you they like a place or they love a teammate or they love a coach, right? You guys will hear him say it in a press conference, and then they'll be like, see, J. Michael's full of crap. He said he loves him. And I know it's a lie, but you don't know it's a lie. But they're saying what they have to say in front of the cameras because what else are you going to say, right? But T.J. Warren is one of those guys that what he says is actually, you can probably take it to the bank. He's one of the few people because he's not really built that way. He's not a politician in the way that Brogdon, you know, that's the word that most people use to describe Brogdon is that he's a politician. T.J. Warren's not a politician like that. What he says is what he actually feels. He thinks, aside from loving Indiana, he thinks and believes the Pacers are willing to pay him when his contract comes up. And so that's part of the draw, too, of why he wants to stay in Indiana. He's found what he considers a home, and he's not trying to pull a Dennis Schroeder. You throw the money on the table and you make the offer to him, he's going to take it and stay. He's not going to wait and try to see what else is out there. I think he really is connected to Indiana, and he kind of – the front office, I think he's on good terms with them, and he likes them. And so that's why, you know, T.J. Warren's healthy. He wants to be in Indiana. Just as I'm saying this, he'll probably get traded just to spite me. But no. Look, nobody on this team is tradable, so I wouldn't be surprised by anything. But I think they like a lot of things about him. The same way they like qualities about T.J. McConnell, like how he's an Indiana guy, T.J. Warren is an Indiana guy as far as the front office is concerned.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people believe that the core three going forward is LeVert, Warren, and Sabonis. And I'm curious your thoughts on Sabonis. And well, there was, you know, some stuff that you reported last year kind of talking about him being viewed as selfish and kind of looking to get his and not really figure things out. So I'm just curious real quick. Can you talk about Sabonis and how you think playing for Carlisle will be different for him in terms of, you know, how they'll use him, and then maybe how he is perceived as maybe not an all-star because he might not get as many touches or as much minutes going forward?
Yeah, I don't think Carlisle is going to have the ball stuck in his hands as much as Bjorkren had it stuck in his hand. And yeah, when I said stuff about Sabonis being selfish, I had one person in particular who I trust on the team tell me that they thought he was going overboard. They thought part of the reason, though, also was because, as I said about Bjorkren, he was such a headstrong coach that he kind of allowed him to be that. Like, there were multiple players in there. And by the way, if you guys don't believe me, and I'm not talking about you guys, but people who listen, all you got to do is go back and look at the games. If you take your eyes off the stat box and say, oh, Sabonis is doing X, Y, and Z, watch what happens when those players go to the bench during timeouts. What is it, an animated conversation or guys kind of bickering and arguing with each other? You can see it. Like, you can physically see it. If you don't want to see it, you won't see it, but it's there. And so I saw a couple of exchanges with people. And so I followed up to try to figure out, like, is this like just, you know, just kind of in the heat of battle? This is happening way more than I've ever been accustomed to seeing. And they felt like Sabonis was hogging the ball too much. And now Sabonis is saying, look, we can't get anything done. Nobody's doing anything. The coach is too stubborn to change anything and make it work. So I'm going to take over and I'm going to do it. Like, and so I think there was some attitude like that in it. And I could kind of understand it from his perspective. When I say he was a little bit selfish, yeah, I mean in the sense that with him, I just don't think the coach, Bjorkren, I just don't think that, to me, that was one of his greatest failings. And he had plenty of them. But he would not tell Sabonis to cool it. And it becomes a chicken and egg argument. Is Sabonis hogging the ball too much and doing X, Y, and Z first? Or is it his him doing that a reaction to a coach who's not doing his job? And sometimes as a coach, you have to tell veterans like Brogdon and Sabonis to take a step down, stand aside, I got this. And that was Bjorkren's biggest failing. I reported that back before the All-Star break when things were really starting to go off the rails. He was afraid to go to those guys and put them in check. And as a result, they kind of took over more and tried to seize, you know, try to control what was happening more. And there's a feeling that they were doing what was in their best interest more so than the team's best interest. And I'm sure they would tell you they were doing what they had to do because they felt like they're the best players and the coach was incompetent. And so I still put like 75% of that blame on Nate Bjorkman. I think if you had a better coach there, none of this stuff happens. But you got to go beyond the stats and the numbers to kind of see what I'm talking about. When I talk about the team being selfish and the issues they had with Sabonis, look, he was doing his thing. There were times where he was the only hope that they had. But Bjorkman had no imagination. His defensive schemes were terrible. Sabonis was pissed off that he kept getting put at the top of the zone and having to try to close out guys like Kevin Durant. Like, I mean, should he be upset about that? Yes, because that's not possibly a smart thing to have him do. So Sabonis, look, I think he stays. He does too many other things well. I just don't think he maybe is going to have a statistically as dominant of a season, but he's still important to what I think they hope to do under Carlisle. But yeah, I don't expect the ball to be slowed down as much. Sabonis to me, and I made these observations, you can go on my Twitter feed last year, he was much better when he got the ball and when he brought it down and he faced up and made a quick decision with the ball and got off it. And I thought the offense was much better than when he was obviously posted up and kind of dribbling from a standstill.
I do think that, dialing it back a little bit for Sabonis could translate to winning, you know, a few more games. And, you know, as you mentioned, Caris LeVert was someone who went on JJ Redick's podcast, basically said his first game with the Pacers, Bjorkman just threw him in there, played him way more minutes than he was prepared for. And, you know, I think that kind of led to a little bit of a rough start to the relationship as LeVert started to kind of do his own thing at times. But when you mentioned the coaching staff, I think they put the bar as maybe as low as it could be in terms of holding players accountable. How do you feel about this coaching staff this time around? They retained Calbert Chaney, Tyler Marsh, a few others, but also brought in Gennaro Pargo, Zach Shue, and a few others that I know I'm missing right now. But how do you feel about this coaching staff outside of Rick Carlisle?
I think a lot remains to be seen when it comes to that. I think Rick Carlisle, though, makes them all stronger.
Exactly.
Just because I think people respect Carlisle that much. Look, it's crazy. Like when you deal with NBA teams, when you have a coach who's accomplished what Carlisle has, which is winning a championship, which nobody else on this roster has done, you know, they have a certain, it kind of requires a certain level of respect that a guy like Bjorkman could never get on his best day. So I think if Rick Carlisle hired me, they probably would respect me. Like, just because he's the guy that hired me. I mean, I think he has that type of influence and pull. The fact that, you know, he's got a 4-year guaranteed deal, he's involved in whatever kind of moves they make or don't make, he's got a bigger voice in this than what coaches have had previously. So you're not just talking to the coach. You're talking to the guy who can probably influence the guy to get your ass moved on out of here. So you're talking to more than a coach. So that's what I think this staff is a result. I think it's all because, you know, Carlisle kind of his influence is going to make it a better staff. I'm not sure. I don't know about Pargo as an assistant coach and what his strengths and weaknesses are and that sort of thing. Calbert Chaney's a guy like, you know, early in the process when they fired Bjorkman, I kind of reported, I said, Chaney's going to stay. Like out of everybody on that staff to stay, Calbert Chaney's going to stick around. Because he was really impressive and he kind of stayed above and away from all that nonsense that went on last season. But, you know, it goes to show you too that, you know, I've reported this as well after they hired Bjorkman. The reason why his assistant coaching staff was what it was, they couldn't get anybody to come here to coach who was of any quality or somebody who had like somebody like a Ronald Norred. Like they couldn't even get somebody, they couldn't get even someone like him to, when I say someone like him, I don't mean like he's a nobody, but you know, he's still not a big name coach, but he's a promising up and coming potential head coaching guy at some point down the line. They couldn't get somebody like him to leave Charlotte to come coach on Bjorkman's staff because people around the league didn't respect Bjorkman. I mean, I guess the flip side of that is that should have been a sign that they broke the best guy for the job if other assistants aren't willing to leave to come join him. And so And by the way, during the season last year, I got yelled at about this by an agent, but it was true because it was true, was that, you know, they were talking about shuffling that assistant staff last year under Bjorkgren during the season. And that's how bad it was. Mm. And I think my report came out that morning, and then later that day, Bataze and Greg Foster, that incident happens against the Kings. The timing was like impeccable. But I think this staff will be respected and treated differently, and it will go down a different way just because of Rick Carlisle being there. If nothing else, worst case scenario, yeah, you don't like this coach. I don't think you're going to get away. You're not going to see Bataze tell somebody to sit the F down this season. I don't think you have to worry about that.
Yeah, that was definitely an interesting moment, and I was kind of surprised how it was all handled. I still can't believe that it actually happened. But here we are, and we're moving forward. And speaking of Bataze, I want to wrap things up here, Jay, just kind of looking at this second unit for a minute, because we know McConnell is going to be the backup point guard, but there's a lot of question marks of who's going to play that 2-5 position, because if they're looking at staggering minutes, does Bataze crack the rotation? What's O'Shea Brissett's role on this team? I know the Pacers really liked him last year, but does Carlisle like him? And then the biggest topic for me is, number one, Justin Holiday. I feel like he's a guy that could clearly start at, or, you know, come off the bench as the three, but does he still want to be here? Because is there a possibility they can move him because he might want to go somewhere else? And then the Edmund Sumner kind of versus Duarte at that two spot. I know Sumner really earned it last year, but to me, you don't invest in 13th overall pick a guy that's 24 years old and start a guy that's on an expiring contract in that second unit over him.
Yeah, I could totally see Duarte jumping Sumner in the rotation. Here's the one thing I have been told about Sumner, though, by somebody who's been with him. They said, man, his three-point shooting right now is off the charts.
Mm.
Like, and like, I was told by someone, like, they said, look, don't sleep on his – you think his three-point shot improved last year? Like, he is shooting the lights out. So, that said, Sumner is an open court player. Duarte seems like he can do either. He can play in half court, it appears. That's my assumption, that based off what I've seen so far. I think he can play in half court as well as he can play, you know, in open court. But I think where Duarte is a little bit different, he's physically stronger and he can play against bigger guys. So I don't necessarily believe that Duarte takes minutes from Sumner, but I think if it did become an either or, I could easily see Duarte bumping him. I can see a lineup where Duarte is playing. He just drained a beautiful three, step up three and transition as we're talking now. I can see a guy like Duarte playing against bigger, stronger guys where Sumner's a little bit more slight in size. But yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of combinations that you wonder about right now. About do you stick with, yeah, does Holiday want to stay? I mean, I know Justin is kind of, you know, he's gotten his 3-year deal. He's in year two of a 3-year deal. You know, he said all the right things, but, you know, his brother Aaron got moved. Did you sense anything in his IG post?
I did.
Okay, yep. Now go back to when I reported or when I said to a conversation with you, Alex, about that I'm not sure if he wants to be here. And then he says that he supposedly calls me out, which is bullshit, because a month later on a conference call, he said that, yeah, he wasn't sure if he was going to come back to Indiana, kind of confirming what I had said all along. I wasn't sure if he was going to come back.
Right.
I thought he liked it, and ideally he wanted to come back, but it wasn't a slam dunk. And now you see what he posts about Aaron when Aaron leaves. Okay. Does it really sound crazy that Justin Holiday could want to be somewhere else? No, he's got guaranteed money now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, no, but I think he wants to stay. He does want a place to call home. He does want a place where he can flourish. I'm assuming that he's going to be a big part of what Rick Carlisle does. Is he going to have the kind of statistical season this year that he had last year? I don't know. Does Duarte cut into his time? Is Duarte better? You know, Holiday's really a three who can play some two, whereas Duarte seems to be a better ball handler, better pick and roll, off pick and roll, probably a little bit physically stronger. So I don't know. What does that mean for Holiday? Does he become expendable? I could see all sorts of like different lineups, possibilities, guys saying, screw it, I want out. And, you know, I think the Pacers have good pieces that regardless if they get to that point, they can get something for them in return. So, I can see just about anything going on. 2 through 5, I'm not sure what any of these lineups going to look like. I mean, does Isaiah Jackson crack any of them? I don't, like I said, if Turner's still there, I don't see that. But if Turner gets moved, then that changes what I think the second units are going to look like. But I wondered the same thing, by the way, on O'Shea Brissett. Like, is Carlisle like him enough to use him the way he was used last year? Because he showed some good things last year, but I don't know. I don't know what Carlisle's thinking right now.
I really believe in O'Shea Brissett, and I really hope that he can still carve out a solid role. I thought he looked good in the first summer league game. Definitely looked better than, you know, a lot of other players on the court, showing that this is an NBA player right here. But as you mentioned for Justin Holiday, it can get messy anytime you're trading a family member, you know. So I could see why that could rub him wrong, of course. But going back to Chris Duarte, this is someone that in the first summer league game, you saw it immediately. The confidence was there. He can create his own shot. So it feels like the Pacers have to carve out some type of role, especially when, you know, they made it known at 13, that was their guy. They weren't going to take any trade offers. So I'm really excited to see how that unfolds. But Jay, I really want to thank you for coming on. Love the chat today. And tell everybody where they can find you on social media.
This is Jay Michael on Twitter.
Easy enough, right? Yeah. All right, everybody. Well, yeah, Jay, we really appreciate you coming on. And we'll have to do it again soon, especially if the Pacers make any more moves this offseason to get you to break it down. But right now, I think that they have made some minor moves. But overall, the big move was getting Rick Carlisle. And this is kind of the hope I think the Pacers front office is, you know, he can change things and make this team a top-tier team in the Eastern Conference, because we had a bad year last year, but the prior year before that, when you had Jeremy Lamb starting for Oladipo, this team was a 4 seed. So I think they believe in this team, but at the same time, I know the East has gotten stronger with some of the moves that have been made. So we'll see what happens. And we got to get you out of here. This game is going on right now. So once again, thank you so much for coming on, Jay.
Fun conversation as always with Jay Michael. You can find him on Twitter at @ThisIsJayMichael. And just a lot of interesting stuff going on. You know, the Pacers having moved back Keelan Martin's guarantee date, as well as acquiring the trade exception for the Doug McDermott sign trade, I think leaves them with kind of exhausting all options. Alex, I think we're not done here making moves.
Yeah, Jay hinted at that. He said, don't be surprised if the Pacers make another move before the season starts. I still would be a little bit shocked if it's not a Jeremy Lamb minor move. If it's a bigger move, I will be completely stunned. I can't see it right now, but I think the most telling thing he said in that conversation was he does not expect this same roster to be intact after the trade deadline. So I'm keeping my eye on that. I know it's miles away from that, about 6 months away from that Fox show. I mean, I'm not looking too far ahead, but I'm just curious to see what they could do. But overall, you know, Jay dropped some really good nuggets, and yeah, I really enjoyed talking with him. Some great stuff there.
Yeah, really did. But Alex, as we wrap up, tell the people on where they can find us on social media.
Yeah, you can find us on Twitter @SettingThePace3. You can find us over on Instagram @PacersTalk. I'm at Alex Golden NBA. My co-host Michael J. Facci is @_FACCI. And if you want to follow us on Facebook, we have a Facebook page called Setting the Pace. I believe it's a slash mark, and then it says Pacers Talk. So something on there you can find us on Facebook as well. We do have two accounts. One is Pacers Talk, but Tyler Smith, the host of Indy Sports Legends, runs that account. Former co-host of the show. We're going to get him back on this offseason. And then Setting the Pace, a Pacers podcast, is on Facebook as well, where we drop stuff in there and people like to have conversations. So yeah, I think that covers it. Did I miss anything?
No, you didn't. But if you are officially now Team Chris Duarte over Moses Moody, then say these three words.
Let's go, Pacers.